They always said an Omega should know her place. I had heard that sentence so many times that it had stopped feeling like a warning and started feeling like a wall, something solid and immovable that I was simply expected to press myself against, flatten my spine, disappear into the stone. My mother had said it to me with love, in the way that people who have been hurt by the world try to protect the ones they love from the same hurt. My pack elders had said it with the detached authority of people who believe the order of things is natural and therefore kind. My supervisor had said it with efficiency, the way she said everything, as instruction, not cruelty. I had believed them. For a long time, I had believed them completely. My name is Bonnie. I am 23 years old. I carry plates for a living. And up until 3 weeks ago, that was the full sum of what I allowed myself to be. The Crescent Hall banquet was not a place for people like me to have opinions, feelings, or reflexes that hadn't been pre-approved. It was a place where I moved silently between tables draped in white linen, where candles smelled of cedar and warm amber, where the laughter of alphas filled the vaulted ceiling like smoke that no one ever thought to clear. My uniform was a plain gray dress with a white apron, and I had learned early on that the best version of myself in that room was the one that no one noticed. I had been working the banquet circuit for 2 years, every formal gathering hosted by the Northern Pax, every territorial summit, every season feast held in venues grand enough to remind the people attending them of their own importance. My supervisor, a broad-shouldered beta woman named Rhea, had hired me because I was, in her words, quiet, quick, and forgettable. She meant it as a compliment. I accepted it as a job description and tried not to think about the fact that being forgettable had once been the thing I feared most in the world, and somewhere along the way had become the thing I relied on most. The Crescent Hall itself sat at the edge of Thornwall City, perched above the river like something out of a story that belonged to someone else entirely. On the night of the Convergence Feast, the annual gathering where all four Alpha territories sent representatives to reaffirm their alliances, the hall had been dressed to intimidate. Dark floral arrangements rose from every surface, black-petaled and architectural. The chandeliers had been fitted with low, amber-tinted bulbs that made everyone look like they were lit from within by something ancient and just barely contained. The scent of pine resin and mulled wine hung heavy and sweet, and underneath it ran something sharper. Power, tension, the specific electricity that fills a room when too many dominant wolves are gathered in one place, and none of them fully trust each other, but all of them need to pretend they do. I had been assigned the eastern corridor of tables, the ones closest to the raised platform where the Alpha King's party would be seated. I did not ask for that assignment. Rhea gave it to me because I was steady-handed, she said. Because I didn't spill. Because I didn't stare. Three qualities she valued in a waitress, and that I had cultivated with the quiet discipline of someone who has learned that drawing attention in the wrong direction, in a room like that one, is never worth whatever small satisfaction caused it. The first hour passed without incident. I carried trays of roasted herb bread and salted butter, refilled crystal goblets with dark red wine, moved between shoulders and chair backs with the practiced silence of someone who has learned to read the geography of a room, which gaps to move through, which conversations to skirt around the edges of, which tables to approach from the left, because the man seated there gestures widely when he talks, and has already knocked one goblet over and blamed the nearest staff member for it. These were the calculations of my working life, small and constant and entirely invisible to the people they protected. I noticed other things, too, the way I always did. The way certain betas leaned slightly away from their alpha counterparts when speaking, creating just enough physical distance to signal deference without performing an obvious bow. The way the alpha representatives from the Western Territory, a delegation of four, all in dark copper and bronze, had positioned themselves with their backs to the wall, watching the room rather than participating in it. The way the young male server named Corwin, who had only been working banquets for 6 weeks, kept his eyes fixed on the floor a beat too long whenever a dominant wolf passed near him. the specific posture of someone who has learned submission as a survival strategy and hasn't yet figured out how to look natural doing it. I recognized it because I had worn it myself. The air shifted approximately 2 minutes before the main doors opened. I felt it before I understood it, a change in pressure, subtle but unmistakable, the way a room feels just before a significant storm, when the atmosphere reorganizes itself around what is coming. Conversations didn't stop. The music didn't falter. But something adjusted, and every wolf in the hall felt it, and the room collectively straightened without anyone deciding to. Then Leander walked in. I had heard about the Alpha King of the Northern Highlands the way you hear about weather before a storm, through other people's reactions to it, through the way everyone around you begins moving differently, through the particular quality of silence that falls over a crowded space when something genuinely powerful enters it. I had served at enough pack gatherings to have developed a working understanding of what Alpha authority looked like in a room, the way it organized space around itself, the way it made other dominant personalities recalibrate almost involuntarily. I was not prepared for how completely and immediately it was true of him. He was taller than I had imagined, which was saying something, because I had imagined him as considerable. He moved through the entrance of the hall with the unhurried certainty of a man who has never once had to wonder whether he would be given space. Space appeared around him, offered freely and instantly by a room that understood what he was before his name was announced. Dark braids pulled back from a face that was all clean angles and cool assessment. Pale blue eyes sweeping the hall with the methodical efficiency of someone cataloging the room rather than arriving in it. Black leather fitted across shoulders broad enough to make the fur trim seem like a practical addition rather than a decorative one. The scars on his forearms were visible and unremarked, worn the same way everything else about him was, without apology and without explanation. Behind him, 2 steps back and to his left, walked a woman I understood immediately to be someone important. She was elegant in the way that only time and survived difficulty can produce. Silver-threaded dark hair coiled precisely at the back of her neck, a deep burgundy dress with long sleeves, a posture so correct it seemed almost architectural. She was announced as Lady Seraphine, the Alpha King's mother, and she moved into the room with a quiet gravity that made her, in some strange way, more noticeable than the power walking ahead of her. Where Leander commanded attention through sheer force, she commanded it through something harder to name. A quality of stillness, perhaps, or the particular confidence of a woman who has already survived the worst things a life can produce and found herself still standing on the other side. I watched her the way I watch most things in that hall, carefully, from the periphery, cataloging without attachment. I was refilling a water goblet at the edge of the platform steps when it happened. I almost missed it. I was half-turned, reaching for the carafe on the side table, when I caught the movement in my peripheral vision. Not the swing itself, not yet, but the intention of it. The specific gathering of energy in a body that has already made a decision. A woman in a copper-colored dress, part of the Western Territory delegation, had risen from her seat, with a smile arranged carefully on her face. She was already close to Lady Seraphine. Too close. Moving with the kind of deliberate casualness that people use when they want the motion to look accidental until it isn't. Her arm was already rising. I don't remember deciding to move. That is the honest truth of it. There was no conscious calculation. No moment where I weighed consequence against action. My body simply moved, the way it moves when something hot gets too close to bare skin. Pure reflex overriding every carefully constructed instinct toward invisibility that I had spent 2 years perfecting. The impact landed across my forearm, flat, sharp, startling in its force. The silence that followed was immediate and total, not the polite conversational quiet between courses. This was the held-breath silence of 200 wolves simultaneously processing something that had no established protocol. An Omega server had physically stepped between a raised hand and the Alpha King's mother. The carafe was somehow still in my other hand, The wine had sloshed in a dark arc across my white apron and was dripping, slow and red, onto the pale marble floor below. The woman in the copper dress stared at me. Shock first, then something hotter and harder underneath it. I turned slowly, because every instinct still functioning was insisting I be very deliberate with my movements right now. Lady Seraphine was looking at me with an expression that took me a moment to identify, because I so rarely had it directed at me. Genuine, unhurried attention, as though I were something worth the full cost of a look. And then, I felt it, the particular weight of a gaze that carries authority. I made myself look up. Leander had not moved from his position at the head of the platform. He hadn't needed to. The room had rearranged itself around the moment, and he stood at the center of it, completely still, pale blue eyes fixed on me with an expression I could not read, and that frightened me more than anything else in the room precisely because I could not read it. Rhea materialized at my elbow within seconds, fingers closing around my arm with a grip that was professional and desperate in equal measure. "Step back," she breathed against my ear. "Step back, be quiet, and do not say one word." I let her move me. I kept my eyes down. I let the room begin to breathe again around me, let voices resume their careful rhythms, let the machinery of the feast restart itself with the practiced efficiency of people who understand that certain things are better absorbed and moved past than examined directly. But as Rhea steered me toward the corridor door, I made the mistake of glancing back. Leander was still watching me. He had not looked away once. Across the length of that entire hall, through the resumed motion of servers and the resumed noise of conversation, his pale eyes were still fixed on the place where I had been standing, tracking the path Rhea was walking me down with an expression that was not anger, not amusement, not the cold dismissal I would have found easiest to survive. It was something closer to calculation, something closer to interest. The corridor door swung shut behind me, and I stood in the narrow service hallway with my wine-stained apron and my aching forearm, and my heart working far too hard for someone who was supposed to be invisible, and I thought, "You have done something you cannot undo." The next morning, a sealed letter arrived at the staff quarters addressed in my name, written in a hand I didn't recognize, pressed with a wax mark I had only ever seen on official Northern Highland documents. I stared at it for a long time before I opened it. "Report to the King's Hall at noon. Do not be late. No signature. No explanation. No indication of what waited for me on the other side of that instruction. Only the absolute certainty, settling cold and quiet into the pit of my stomach, that whatever came next, it was already in motion." I changed my apron 3 times that morning. Not because the first two were stained. They weren't. I had washed the wine out the night before, scrubbing at the fabric in the small stone sink of the staff quarters bathroom until the water ran clear and my hands were raw from the cold. The aprons were fine. I kept changing them because standing in front of the narrow mirror above the sink and adjusting the ties gave my hands something to do, and my hands very badly needed something to do. Corwin found me in the hallway at 11:30, leaning against the wall outside the linen closet, with the sealed letter still folded in my pocket, even though I had read it 11 times and had long since memorized its 8 words. He was 20 years old, slight in the way that young beta males sometimes are before their secondary characteristics fully settle, with an honest face and the kind of eyes that always looked slightly worried even when nothing was wrong. He had been worried since he'd heard about last night, which meant his expression this morning was doing something complicated that I didn't have the emotional capacity to parse. "They're saying the Western delegation filed a formal grievance," he said, without preamble, because Corwin had never successfully learned the art of easing into difficult information. "Against you. For interference." I looked at him. "A formal grievance. With the Convergence Council." He hesitated. "Rhea's been in her office since 7. She won't open the door." I absorbed this. The Convergence Council was the administrative body that governed inter-PAC conduct at sanctioned events, a council of elders and representatives whose primary function, as far as I had ever understood it, was to ensure that no action taken at a formal gathering could be construed as an act of aggression between territories. A waitress stepping between a raised hand and the Alpha King's mother was apparently the kind of thing that required formal documentation. "A grievance filed by whom?" I asked. "Lady Voss." He said the name carefully, the way you say the name of something you're not sure is safe to say aloud. "The woman in the copper dress. She's the Western Alpha's cousin. She's saying you assaulted her." The word landed with the particular weight of something absurd that has nonetheless been made official. I had blocked a slap. I was now, apparently, a documented aggressor at an Interpac summit. "Go back to your shift," I told Corwin. "Bonnie, please." I said it quietly, the way I said most things. "I'll be fine." He looked at me for a moment longer than was comfortable, and I could see him doing the calculation that young, kind people do when they want to help and understand they can't. The quiet arithmetic of helplessness. Then he nodded once and walked back down the hall toward the kitchens. I straightened my apron. I checked the letter one more time, as though the words might have changed overnight into something less irrevocable. They hadn't. I walked to the King's Hall. Thornwall City in the gray morning light was a different place than it was under the amber chandeliers of the Crescent Hall. The streets between the staff quarters and the King's Hall were cobbled and steep, lined with buildings of dark stone that had been old for a very long time and seemed comfortable with it. The river was audible from almost everywhere in the city, a constant low presence beneath the sounds of market stalls opening and cartwheels on stone. The air smelled of wood smoke and bread from the bakeries opening their shutters, and underneath that, the mineral cold of the river, and underneath that, pine. Always pine, this far into Northern Highland territory, as though the forest had laid a permanent claim on the air itself. I walked with my hands clasped in front of me and my eyes ahead and tried very hard not to think about the formal grievance or about Rhea behind her closed door or about the particular quality of pale blue eyes that had followed me across the silent hall. The King's Hall was not the Crescent Hall. Where the Crescent Hall had been designed for ceremony and atmosphere, the King's Hall was designed for the specific business of governance, a wide, dark building of fitted stone with high narrow windows, positioned at the center of the city on a slight elevation that meant you were always walking uphill to reach it. The effect, I suspected, was entirely intentional. Two guards in Northern Highland black flanked the entrance. They looked at me when I arrived, then at each other, then back at me with the particular expression of men who had been told to expect someone and were reconciling what they'd been told with what they were seeing. "Bonnie," I said. I was summoned. One of them, older, with a jaw like a shelf, checked a list, found my name, stepped aside without a word. The interior of the King's Hall smelled of old paper, leather, and something faintly metallic that I associated with authority in the way that certain smells become permanently linked to certain experiences. The corridor I was directed through was wide and lined with maps. Enormous, detailed territorial maps in dark frames, each one marked with boundary lines and pack sigils in faded ink. I kept my eyes on them as I walked, because looking at maps felt safer than thinking about where I was going. The door at the end of the corridor was open. I stopped in the doorway because my feet made the decision before the rest of me caught up. The room was a study. Large, book-lined, the kind of room that has been actively used rather than decorated. Papers covered the desk in organized layers. There was a globe on a stand near the window, a detailed topographical model of the Northern Highlands, and maps on these walls, too. But these ones had been marked in fresh ink, recently updated, with notes and handwriting too small to read from where I stood. Leander was standing with his back to me, looking out of the tall window at the city below. He was in simpler clothing than the night before, dark trousers, a black shirt with the sleeves rolled to the elbow, no fur, no armor, no formal presentation. It should have made him seem less imposing. It didn't. If anything, the absence of ceremony made the authority more visible, the way removing scaffolding from a completed building reveals the structure itself. He didn't turn when I entered, but he spoke immediately. "Close the door." His voice was lower than I expected, not softer. Nothing about the way he spoke suggested accommodation, but lower, with a resonance that settled into the room like a second gravity. I closed the door. My hands were steady. I was very proud of my hands in that moment. "You know why you're here," he said, still not turning. "Lady Voss filed a grievance," I said, "against me." "She filed it within an hour of the incident." He turned then, and I made myself hold my ground, which required more effort than I would have liked to admit. In the gray morning light of the study, without the amber warmth of the banquet hall, he looked sharper, the pale eyes cooler, the angles of his face more pronounced. He was looking at me with the same unreadable expression from the night before, the one that I still couldn't name. "She's calling it assault. Unprovoked physical contact with a representative of an allied territory." The absurdity of it rose in my throat. I pressed it down. "I blocked a slap," I said. My voice came out steadier than I felt. "That was directed at your mother." Something moved across his expression. Quick, controlled, gone before I could identify it. "I know what you did," he said. "I was in the room." "Then you know it wasn't unprovoked." The silence that followed was the kind that has weight. He studied me for a long moment, the kind of study that makes you aware of every specific thing about yourself. The plainness of the gray dress, the single braid of pale hair over one shoulder, the wine stain that hadn't quite fully come out of the apron hem, the way I was clasping my hands in front of me, the same way I always did when I was trying to look calmer than I was. "Sit down," he said. It wasn't a request, but it also wasn't quite what I had been bracing for. I sat in the chair across from the desk. He remained standing, which meant I had to look up at him, which I suspected was not an accident. "Lady Voss's grievance has been reviewed by the Convergence Council this morning," he said. "They've determined that the incident falls within a gray area of the conduct statutes. Physical intervention during a formal gathering, regardless of intent." My stomach dropped. Gray area meaning that under normal circumstances, you would be facing a formal censure and a permanent ban from sanctioned PAC events. He paused. "These are not normal circumstances." I waited. "My mother," he said, and something in his voice shifted very slightly, like a door opening a fraction in a wall that is otherwise solid, "has requested that the grievance be dismissed, on the grounds that your action constituted protection, not aggression." I exhaled. "The council," he continued, "does not dismiss grievances on the request of individuals, regardless of rank, including mine." Another pause, and this one had a different quality to it, deliberate, considered. "Which means the grievance remains active, and you remain in a complicated position." "What does that mean for me?" I asked. He looked at me steadily. "It means," he said, "that I have a proposal." Outside the tall window, the city moved through its gray morning, indifferent to the specific suspended moment happening in a book-lined study above it. The river ran. The market stalls opened. The pine-cold air moved through the streets of Thornwall City the way it always had. Inside the room, I sat very still and waited to hear what the Alpha King of the Northern Highlands considered a proposal. And I thought, with a clarity that surprised me, whatever it is, something has already changed. The only question is what it changes into. The proposal was not what I expected. I had prepared myself. In the 30 seconds between his last word and whatever came next, for something transactional and cold, a legal arrangement, a formal statement I would be required to sign, perhaps a scripted account of the previous night's events that could be submitted to the Convergence Council as counter-evidence. something administrative, something that kept me at the correct distance from anything that mattered. What he said was, "I want you on staff, here, in the King's Hall." I stared at him. "Temporarily," he added, with the particular tone of someone who has learned to qualify statements not because they doubt them, but because they understand how they land. "Until the council closes the grievance file. My mother has suggested that the most effective argument against the censure is demonstrated trust, that the household of the Alpha King does not consider you a threat or an aggressor, that we have, in fact, chosen to extend you employment." "Your mother suggested this," I said. "She's persuasive," he said. It wasn't quite dry. It wasn't quite warm. It landed somewhere in between, and I didn't know what to do with it. I looked down at my hands, then back up at him, because looking down felt like conceding something I hadn't decided to concede yet. "What would the position be?" "Household staff. You'd be assigned to the residential wing, assisting with correspondence management, receiving callers, general support for my mother's schedule while she remains in Thornwall for the season." He paused. "You would be given appropriate quarters in the hall. Your current employment with the banquet circuit would be suspended for the duration." I thought about Rhea behind her closed door. I thought about Corwin's worried face in the hallway. I thought about the word assault attached to my name in a formal council document, sitting in a file somewhere in this very building, patient and permanent. "And if I decline?" I asked. The question cost me something to ask. I felt it leave my mouth and understood immediately that it was the kind of question that declared a position, that I was someone who needed to know the shape of a choice before making it, even when the alternative was probably worse. Something shifted in his expression, not displeasure, something that resembled, faintly and briefly, a kind of recognition. "If you decline," he said, "the grievance proceeds through standard channels. The council will likely rule in Lady Voss's favor, given the political pressures involved. You will be censured and barred from sanctioned events." A pause. "I won't compel you. That is not what this is." I believed him. I wasn't entirely sure why I believed him, given that I had known him for less than 20 minutes across 2 separate encounters. But the statement had the texture of something he meant rather than something he was saying for effect, and I had spent enough time reading rooms and people to have developed some instinct for the difference. "I'll need to collect my things from the staff quarters," I said. He nodded once, already turning back toward the desk. "Someone will take you. Be back before the evening session." I stood. I straightened my apron out of pure habit, then felt faintly absurd doing it. "Mr.," I stopped. "What do I call you?" He looked up from the papers he had already begun reviewing. The pale eyes held something that might, in a different face, have been amusement. "Leander," he said. "In this hall, titles are used in formal sessions, not in passing." I nodded. I walked to the door. I had my hand on the frame when his voice reached me, quieter than before, with a different quality to it. Less instruction, more something else. "You didn't flinch," he said. "Last night, when you stepped in." "I didn't turn around. I know." "Most people would have." "I know that too," I said. And I walked out before the conversation could become something I didn't yet have the vocabulary to navigate. The residential wing of the King's Hall was nothing like the staff quarters I had been living in for 2 years. It wasn't excessive. I want to be clear about that, because excessive would have been easier to hold at arm's length, easier to dismiss as the performance of wealth. The room I was given was large by any standard I had previously applied to rooms, with a window that looked south over the river, and walls of warm, dark stone hung with tapestries in deep green and brown that absorbed the gray morning light and turned it into something almost amber. The bed had a proper frame and linen that smelled of lavender. There was a writing desk and a small bookshelf, half filled with volumes that had clearly been read, rather than displayed. I sat on the edge of the bed for a moment, after the guard left me, and tried to locate myself inside the sequence of events that had produced this particular room, this particular morning, this particular version of my life. 24 hours ago, I had been carrying a carafe of water toward an unremarkable table at the eastern edge of a banquet hall. I unpacked my single bag with the efficiency of someone accustomed to not having many things to unpack. Lady Seraphine found me that same afternoon. I was in the small anteroom adjacent to her private sitting room, a space stacked with correspondence that apparently needed organizing, a task that had been described to me as my primary responsibility and that I was approaching with the focused attention I gave to anything I could actually control. The letters were sorted by territory of origin, then by date received, then cross-referenced against a ledger that recorded which ones had received formal replies and which were still pending. It was meticulous and quiet, and I was very grateful for it. I heard her before I saw her. The precise, unhurried sound of footsteps that knew exactly where they were going. She appeared in the doorway of the anteroom and regarded the organized stacks of correspondence with an expression of what I could only describe as satisfaction. "You alphabetized by territory," she said. "And chronologically within each section," I said. "I can reorganize if you prefer a different system." I've been asking for someone to sort that correspondence for 3 weeks," she said, moving into the room with the ease of someone entirely at home in it. The last two assistants filed everything by color of the envelope seal, which tells me a great deal about how they approached problems in general. She settled into the chair near the window, the good chair, the one positioned to catch the most light, which told me she spent real time in this room, and looked at me with the same quality of unhurried attention she had directed at me in the banquet hall. Up close, she was more vivid than she had seemed at a distance. The silver in her hair caught the light. Her eyes were a darker blue than her son's, warmer at the edges. "How is your arm?" she asked. The question surprised me into honesty. "Sore," I said. "It's fine." "It isn't nothing. What you did," she said. "I want you to understand that I know that." I looked at the correspondence in my hands and set it down carefully on the appropriate stack. "I reacted," I said. "I didn't think about it." "No," she agreed. "That's precisely why it means what it means." I didn't know what to do with that, so I said nothing, which seemed to be acceptable. She didn't press. She sat in her chair and watched the river through the window for a moment. And I returned to the correspondence, and the room was quiet, in a way that felt, strangely, like it had been quiet together before. "Lady Voss," she said after a while, "has been a problem for longer than last night." I kept my eyes on the letters. "That isn't my business." "No," she said, "but it's your context. You should have it." She folded her hands in her lap, with the same composed deliberateness her son used when he wanted to be precise. "The Western Territory has been positioning itself against the Northern Highland Alliance for 2 seasons. Lady Voss is her Alpha cousin's instrument in that effort. What happened last night was not a random act of personal animosity." "It was a message," I said, before I could stop myself. She looked at me with something warm in her expression. "Yes, it was a message. And I interrupted it." "You did." A pause. "Which is why the grievance exists. Because the message didn't land, and someone needed to be made responsible for that." I thought about this. I thought about Lady Voss's face in the moment after. Not just humiliated, but recalculating. Not just angry at me specifically, but angry in the way people are when a plan has been disrupted by something they hadn't accounted for. "She'll try again," I said. "Almost certainly," Lady Seraphine agreed. "In a different form, through different channels." She looked at me steadily. "Which is part of why you being here is useful." I met her eyes. "You mean because if something happens to me in this hall, It implicates the Western territory directly. The silence that followed had a different quality than the ones before it. You're quite sharp, she said. Not unkindly. Almost, I thought with relief. I carry plates for a living, I said. I'm not sharp. I just pay attention. In my experience, she said, rising from her chair with the unhurried grace that seemed to be her natural state of motion. Those two things are considerably more connected than most people allow. She moved toward the door, then paused at the threshold and turned back to look at me one more time. Dinner is at 7 in the main hall. Staff eat in the east corridor. But tonight, Leander has asked that you join the family table. I stared at her. Don't be late, she said. And she was gone before I could form a single word in response. I stood in the anteroom surrounded by organized correspondence and thought about a great many things simultaneously. About Lady Voss recalculating. About the Convergence Council's open file. About pale blue eyes in a gray morning study. About the specific way someone's voice changes when they are saying something they mean. And then I thought, dinner is at 7. And I thought, I have nothing appropriate to wear. And then, underneath both of those thoughts, something quieter and harder to look at directly. Something that felt, cautiously and against my better judgment, like the first edge of wanting to stay. Dinner at the family table of the Alpha King turned out to be less ceremonial and more unsettling than I had prepared for. I had borrowed a dress from Morin, one of the permanent household staff, a woman in her mid-40s with short, dark hair and the specific no-nonsense warmth of someone who has worked in a large household long enough to have seen everything twice and stopped being surprised by any of it. She had appeared at my door at 6:30 with a dark navy dress draped over one arm, and the expression of someone who had been briefed on my situation and had formed a practical opinion about it. "It'll be slightly long on you," she said, assessing me with the frank efficiency of someone taking measurements. "But it's appropriate. That's what matters tonight." "Does this happen often?" I asked, pulling the dress on behind the partition. "Staff being invited to the family table?" "Never," she said. Without particular drama, in 14 years, not once. I came out from behind the partition. She looked at me, made a small sound of professional satisfaction, and adjusted the shoulder seam with two quick movements of her hands. "Is that supposed to make me feel better?" I asked. "It's supposed to make you feel informed," she said. "There's a difference. Head up, shoulders back. You have a good posture when you remember to use it." I thought about that as I walked to the main hall. The distinction between feeling better and feeling informed. It seemed like the kind of distinction that mattered in a place like this. The family table was set in a smaller dining room adjacent to the main hall, a room I hadn't seen yet, warmer and lower ceiling than the formal spaces, with a fireplace that was actually being used, and dark wood furniture that showed the honest wear of regular meals rather than occasional ceremony. It smelled of roasted meat and something herbed and faintly sweet, and the fire made everything amber. And for a disorienting moment it reminded me of the banquet hall, except that almost everything about it was the opposite of the banquet hall. Intimate instead of vast, functional instead of performative, the kind of room where the people in it actually lived rather than appeared. There were 4 people already seated when I arrived. Lady Seraphine, at the near end of the table, who acknowledged my entrance with a small nod that managed to communicate both welcome and the information that I should stop hesitating in the doorway. Leander, at the head, with a document still in his hand that he set down with what looked like conscious effort when I entered, as though putting it away was an act requiring decision rather than reflex. He looked at me briefly and said nothing, which I was beginning to understand was his version of acknowledgement in informal settings, and 2 others I hadn't met. The first was a young man of perhaps 25, lean where Leander was broad, with the same dark coloring, but an entirely different energy. Where Leander's presence organized a room through gravity, This man's presence animated it, like a fire that had decided to take a more social form. He was leaning back in his chair with the comfortable ease of someone entirely at home, and he looked at me when I entered with open, uncomplicated curiosity. "So you're Bonnie," he said. "Cade." He tilted his head toward himself in introduction. "I'm the less intimidating brother, which, granted, is a low bar." "Sit down, Cade," Leander said, without looking up from where he had picked the document back up. "I am sitting down." "You're performing sitting down. There's a difference." I sat in the empty chair between Lady Seraphine and the fourth person at the table, a woman of about 30, with warm brown skin and dark eyes that assessed me with a calm, professional interest that reminded me of the way Rhea looked at new staff members. She had strong hands and a posture that suggested she spent significant time in physical training, and she wore the Northern Highland household sigil on a clasp at her collar. "Cena," she said, "head of the king's personal guard." A pause. "I know who you are." "Everyone seems to," I said.
"You're the first Omega to physically intervene in a territorial incident at a convergence summit," she said, "in recorded history. People tend to know who first are." I picked up the water glass in front of me and drank from it because it gave my hands something appropriate to do. Dinner proceeded with a rhythm I hadn't expected. Not stiff, not formal, but not entirely relaxed either. There was a current underneath it, a careful quality to certain exchanges, the kind that exists in households where significant things are happening, and the people at the table are managing the balance between normal life and the weight of those significant things. Cade talked more than anyone else, with the practiced ease of someone who had long ago accepted the role of social lubricant and had made a genuine craft of it. Cena ate with focused efficiency and spoke seldom but precisely when she did. Lady Seraphine asked me 3 questions over the course of the meal, about where I had grown up, about how long I had been working the banquet circuit, about whether I had always been good at organizing information. And each one landed with the quality of something that had been considered before being asked. Leander said very little for most of the meal. I was aware of him the way you are aware of something at the edge of your vision, not because I was looking at him, but because the room was organized around him in a way that made not being aware of him a kind of active effort. When he did speak, the table's attention shifted to him with the natural, unforced quality of water finding its level. Halfway through the second course, Cade said, "The council is meeting again tomorrow morning. About the Voss grievance." The quality of the room changed. "I know," Leander said. "There's pressure from the Western delegation. They want a ruling before the end of the Convergence Week." "I know that, too. They're saying if the council dismisses the grievance without formal consequence, the Western Alpha will read it as the Northern Highland House protecting one of its own at the expense of..." "Cade." Leander's voice didn't rise. "It didn't need to." "I'm aware." Cade subsided, not with the wounded compliance of someone who had been silenced, but with the easy acceptance of someone who had made his point and was satisfied with having made it. He glanced at me briefly, not with pity, but with something more complicated and more honest. The look of someone who wants you to understand something without being the one to say it directly. I understood it. The grievance wasn't going to go away easily. My being here helped, but it wasn't a solution. It was a temporary counterweight. After the meal, as the plates were being cleared and Lady Seraphine had moved to the chair near the fire with a book she clearly had no intention of reading, Leander said my name. Just that. Bonnie. I stopped at the edge of the doorway where I had been intending to make a quiet exit. "Yes. Walk with me." It wasn't a request. I was starting to understand that very few things he said were requests, but that there was a distinction, which I was also starting to identify, between the things that were instructions and the things that were something else that simply used the same grammatical shape. This was the something else. We walked the outer corridor of the residential wing, which was long and lined with those territorial maps I had noticed on my way in.
and the night had come fully down outside the narrow windows, and the corridor was lit by wall-mounted lamps that turned the stone warm. He walked at a pace that was slower than I expected from someone his size, and I walked beside him, not quite at his shoulder, not quite behind him, an in-between distance that I hadn't consciously chosen, but that seemed to be what the space between us naturally produced. He didn't speak for almost a full minute. I had learned, over the course of the day, that his silences were not empty. They were occupied, working silences, and interrupting them was the wrong instinct. "The council will likely rule against you," he said finally, "tomorrow or the day after. Lady Voss's family has 2 council seats through the Western Delegation's alliance structure. The votes are already spoken for." "I assumed something like that," I said. "The censure can be appealed," he said. "But an appeal takes time and requires a formal sponsor from a ranked household." I looked at the maps on the wall as we passed them. The Northern Highlands were vast on paper, all that territory marked and named and bounded. The kind of space that required a different relationship with distance than anything I had grown up understanding. "Are you offering to sponsor an appeal?" I asked. "I'm telling you the mechanism exists," he said. "Whether I offer it depends on something I want to ask you." I stopped walking. He stopped a half step later and turned to look at me. And in the warm lamplight of the corridor, he looked different than he had in the gray morning study. Less sharp, the pale eyes less cool, the angles of his face holding something that the daylight had kept controlled. "Ask," I said. "Why did you step in?" He asked it the way he said most things, directly, without the softening that most people use to make difficult questions easier to refuse. Not the reflex of it. "You told me that already. I mean, why you? Specifically. An Omega server at a formal summit, in a room full of ranked wolves, any one of whom could have and should have acted. Why did your body choose to move when no one else's did?" The question landed somewhere deep and inconvenient. I thought about it honestly, the way I rarely let myself think about the things I did instinctively, because examining instincts too closely has a way of either validating or dismantling them, and I had generally preferred not to know which. "Because she looked like someone who had already survived a great deal," I said finally. "Your mother. And because I thought, I don't know, that she shouldn't have to survive this one too. Not in a room full of people who should have been protecting her." The corridor was very quiet. Leander looked at me for a long moment. Something in his expression moved. Not the controlled, quick movement I had seen in the study that morning, but something slower and less guarded. Something that came from somewhere real and didn't fully retract before I saw it. "She raised me alone," he said. "After my father. There were people then, too, who thought her position made her a useful target." He didn't say anything else. He didn't need to. The sentence completed itself in the space between us, in the specific quality of a silence shared between 2 people who have both, in very different ways and very different rooms, understood what it means to be the person who doesn't get protected. "I'll sponsor the appeal," he said, "regardless of the council's ruling." He turned and walked back the way we had come, and I stood in the corridor alone for a moment, with the warmth of the lamps and the vast mapped territories on the walls, and something shifting quietly in my chest that I was not yet ready to name, but could no longer honestly pretend wasn't there. The council ruled against me on a Thursday. I knew before the official notification arrived. Sina told me at breakfast with the directness I had come to expect from her. The kind that delivers difficult information without decoration because she believed correctly that people deserve to know what is coming toward them with enough time to prepare. The censure was formal and documented, barred from all sanctioned PAC events for a period of 18 months. My name entered into the Convergence Council's conduct record, alongside Lady Voss's account of events, which described me as an unpredictable and aggressive presence at a diplomatic gathering. Corwin sent a letter from the staff quarters that arrived the same morning. It was short, and slightly smudged, the way his writing always was when he wrote quickly, and it said, "I know it isn't fair. I'm sorry. I hope wherever you land next is better than where you've been." I folded it and kept it. Marin knocked on my door at mid-morning and told me, without particular ceremony, that my quarters remained mine until the appeal was resolved, and that the correspondence work in the anteroom wasn't going to organize itself. I went back to work, because work was the thing I knew how to do when everything else was uncertain. And because Lady Seraphine's accumulated correspondence genuinely was a significant undertaking, and focusing on it kept the specific quality of the injustice from settling too heavily in my chest. Leander filed the appeal that same afternoon. I knew because Cade told me, appearing in the doorway of the anteroom with two cups of tea and the expression of someone who has decided that solidarity is best expressed through beverage and proximity. He set one cup on the edge of the correspondence table without asking whether I wanted it, which I appreciated more than I would have been able to explain. "He filed it under household protection doctrine," Cade said, settling into the chair Lady Seraphine usually occupied near the window. "Which means it goes above the Convergence Council to the Highland Elder Assembly. Longer process, but different voting structure. The Western delegation doesn't hold seats there." "How long?" I asked. "Weeks, maybe 2 months." He wrapped both hands around his cup and looked at me with that open, uncomplicated quality that was entirely his own. "Does that bother you, staying that long?" I thought about the question honestly. 2 months ago, I would have found it straightforwardly frightening. Too long, too exposed, too far outside the carefully maintained smallness of my life. The staff quarters and the banquet circuit, and the practiced invisibility that kept everything manageable. "No," I said, and meant it. "It doesn't bother me." Cade smiled. Not the easy social smile he used at the dinner table, but something smaller and more genuine underneath it. "Good," he said. "Because you're the first person who's organized that correspondence correctly in 3 years, and my mother is insufferably pleased about it." The weeks that followed had a rhythm I hadn't expected to settle into so naturally. Mornings were correspondence and scheduling. Lady Seraphine's calendar was complex, filled with the specific obligations of a woman who occupied a significant social position, with neither official title nor formal authority, which meant that everything she did was done through relationship and presence rather than rank, and managing it required a different kind of attention than I had applied to anything before. I learned the names and histories of the people who wrote to her, the political textures of their requests, which invitations she accepted for genuine interest, and which she accepted because the refusal would cost more than the attendance. She taught me most of this directly, without ceremony, sitting in her chair near the window while I worked, offering context when it was useful, asking my opinion with a consistency that still, weeks in, caught me slightly off guard every time. I had not been in many environments where my opinion was considered a resource. Afternoon sometimes took me to other parts of the hall, delivering documents to Sina's office in the Eastern Wing, where Sina would briefly and efficiently include me in whatever logistical problem she was currently solving, treating my presence as simply part of the hall's functioning machinery. The guard unit Sina commanded, 6 wolves in total, all Northern Highland ranked, had settled into an easy professional acknowledgement of me that I found steadying. They called me by name. They moved aside in corridors without the particular quality of deference that carries condescension inside it. Evenings were sometimes dinner at the family table, sometimes a meal in the east corridor with Marin and 2 other permanent staff members, a quiet older man named Dov, who managed the hall's supply ledgers, and a young woman named Petra, who seemed to be responsible for everything that didn't fall into anyone else's category, and performed this function with cheerful, relentless competence. And sometimes, not every evening, not according to any schedule I could identify, Leander would be in the library when I passed it on the way back from Lady Seraphine's sitting room. The library was on the 2nd floor of the residential wing, a long room that smelled permanently of old paper and cedarwood, with reading chairs positioned near the windows
and a standing desk in the corner that was clearly where Leander worked when he wanted to work without being findable. The first time I passed and saw the light under the door, I kept walking. The second time I paused without entirely deciding to. The third time he said, without looking up from whatever he was reading, there's a chair. So I sat in it. We rarely talked at length during those evenings. He worked or read documents or stood at the window with the particular stillness of someone processing something they weren't ready to voice. I read from the shelf. The volumes were varied and well used, historical accounts and territorial records and occasionally things that were simply stories, which surprised me and which I didn't comment on. The silence between us had changed from the weighted, careful silence of our early conversations into something easier. Not comfortable exactly, not yet, but no longer requiring active maintenance. A silence that had decided to exist without explaining itself. One night, perhaps 5 weeks in, he looked up from his desk and said, "What did you want to be?" Before the banquet circuit, I looked up from the book in my lap. "A cartographer," I said, and watched something shift in his expression. "A cartographer," he repeated. "I grew up in a border territory," I said. The edges of things always seemed more interesting than the centers. I looked back at the book. It wasn't practical. "Most interesting things aren't," he said. He was quiet for a moment. "I'll have Sina pull the survey records for the eastern boundary. They need updating. The last formal survey was 8 years ago." Another pause, and then more quietly, "If you wanted to look at them." I looked at him. He had already returned his eyes to his document, in the particular way of someone who has said something they meant and has decided that looking away is the correct next move. "I'd like that," I said. The Elder Assembly ruled 6 weeks after Leander filed the appeal. The censure was overturned. My conduct record cleared. Lady Voss's grievance formally dismissed on the grounds of insufficient evidence of aggressive intent. The Assembly had reviewed the accounts of 14 witnesses present in the banquet hall that night, and the consensus was, apparently, unambiguous. Sina told me this one too, over breakfast, with the same directness and a slightly different quality underneath it. Something that, in Sina's controlled economy of expression, passed for satisfaction. Cade celebrated by appearing at the anteroom door with something that he claimed was a traditional Northern Highland acknowledgement cake, and that appeared to be, in practical terms, a very good honey cake that Marin had almost certainly made. We ate it over the correspondence table while Lady Seraphine pretended to disapprove and didn't succeed. That evening, I found Leander in the library. He looked up when I came in and set down his document in the way I had come to recognize. The conscious, decided movement of someone choosing to be present rather than working. "It's done," I said. "Yes." I stood in the middle of the room for a moment, aware of the specific weight of what had arrived, not just the legal resolution, but the question it opened underneath it, the one I had been carrying for 6 weeks with the careful, disciplined attention of someone who has learned to hold uncertain things without forcing them to resolve before they're ready. "I could leave," I said. "Now that it's resolved, go back to something, some version of a normal life." "You could," he said. No inflection, no persuasion. The same quality he had used in the study on that first morning. "I won't compel you. That is not what this is." "I don't want to," I said. The library was quiet. The cedarwood smell and the old paper and the amber lamp on the standing desk. Outside, the river was doing what it always did, indifferent and constant, and the city was settling into its night, and the pine-cold air of the northern highlands moved through the dark in the way it had for longer than any of us had been here to notice it. Leander rose from the desk. He crossed the room with the same unhurried certainty I had watched organize every space he moved through, and he stopped in front of me at a distance that was closer than any we had yet maintained, close enough that I could see the pale blue of his eyes clearly in the warm lamplight, and what was in them
was not the controlled, assessing expression I had catalogued over weeks of careful observation. It was something unguarded, something that had been waiting, patient and steady, for exactly this, for the moment when the things that needed resolving had resolved, and what remained was simply true. "Then stay," he said. "Not a command. Not a negotiation. Something that had the texture of the most honest things. Offered without guarantee. Without architecture. Without anything around it except itself." I thought about Corwin's smudged letter. About Rhea's closed door and gray dress aprons and the practiced art of being forgettable. About a woman in a copper dress and a raised arm, and the specific moment when a body moves before a mind decides, and how that single, unremarkable reflex had walked me into a life I hadn't known I was allowed to want. "All right," I said. What came after that was not a fairy tale resolution. I want to be honest about that, because honesty seemed to be the only currency that had ever worked between us, and I saw no reason to stop now. The Western Territory's political maneuvering did not end with Lady Voss's dismissed grievance. There were two more formal complaints filed against the Northern Highland Alliance over the following months, neither of them involving me directly, but both of them requiring the kind of careful, sustained attention that kept Leander and Sina working long hours and kept the library lamp burning later than it should have. Cade spent 6 weeks traveling to the Southern Territories as a diplomatic representative, and came back thinner and more serious. And slowly, over several weeks of honey cake and family dinners, became himself again. Lady Seraphine remained in Thornwall through the winter. We worked together every morning in the anteroom, and she taught me more about the architecture of power in those months, how it was built and maintained and occasionally dismantled, than I had learned in the preceding 23 years of my life combined. She did it the way she did most things, without announcement, through the simple act of treating me as someone worth teaching. I updated the Eastern Boundary Surveys, all of them. It took 4 months and required 3 field visits to border territories that Sina accompanied me on with the professional thoroughness of someone who considers every journey a potential security situation, which I found both slightly excessive and genuinely reassuring. The completed surveys were formally submitted to the Highland Cartographic Archive in the spring. My name was on the title page. I held the bound copy for a long moment when it arrived. Leander found me in the library that evening, with it still in my hands. He looked at my name on the cover, at my hands holding it, at whatever was on my face that I wasn't managing as carefully as usual, and said nothing, because he had learned, as I had learned about him, that some moments are not improved by words. He sat in the chair beside mine. He reached over and turned to the first map, the northeastern boundary, the one I had spent the most time on, the one where the old survey had been most significantly wrong, and looked at it with the focused, genuine attention of someone who understood what they were looking at. We sat like that for a long time, in the cedarwood-scented quiet, while the river ran outside and the city settled into its night around us. In the months that followed, the Western Territory's political pressure eventually collapsed under the weight of its own overextension. 3 territories withdrew from their alliance structure within the same season, for separate reasons that nonetheless all traced back to the same pattern of behavior that had produced Lady Voss, and the copper dress, and the raised arm in the banquet hall. The Convergence Council reformed its conduct statutes the following year, adding clearer language around the definition of protective intervention. Sena told me this with an expression of maximum professional satisfaction. Lady Voss herself never returned to a Northern Highland-sanctioned event. What she returned to was her own territory, and her own reckoning with the specific costs of the kind of plan that depends on no one stepping in. Corwin was hired by the Kingshall permanent staff the following spring. I had mentioned his name to Marin in passing, described his steadiness and his honest face, and the way he had stood in a hallway with nothing useful to offer, and offered his presence anyway, which I had come to understand was not a small thing. He arrived nervous and careful, and within 3 months had become indispensable in the way that genuinely good people tend to, quietly and without requiring anyone to announce it. and Leander. Leander, who organized rooms by existing in them, who spoke less than almost anyone I had ever known, and meant more with what he said than most people managed with everything, who had watched me across a silent banquet hall with an expression I couldn't read and had turned out, over the slow accumulation of mornings and corridors and library evenings, to simply be someone who paid attention and considered that a form of care. Leander remained. Not in the way of stories that tie everything into a single luminous moment and call it an ending. In the way of actual things, present, complicated, occasionally frustrating, frequently steady, in the way of someone who had said stay and meant it as a permanent offer rather than a temporary one, and who showed that he meant it, not through grand gestures, but through the thousand small, consistent choices that constitute a life shared rather than a life adjacent. The last morning of that first year, I stood at the window of the room that had long since stopped feeling borrowed and looked out at the river below. Silver in the early light, constant and indifferent, and somehow, because of that constancy, comforting, and thought about the woman I had been 12 months ago, pressing herself flat against walls, cultivating invisibility, carrying plates through rooms full of people who were never meant to see her. She had not been wrong to survive the way she survived. I wanted to be clear about that, even just to myself. The smallness had been a strategy, not a character flaw. The invisibility had been a tool, not a destiny. But tools are for using, and strategies are for the conditions that require them, and the conditions had changed. I had changed them, with a reflex, with a forearm, with 8 words on a sealed letter and a choice to walk toward them instead of away. Leander appeared in the doorway behind me. I heard him before I saw him. The particular quality of his footsteps that I now knew as well as my own. And he looked at me at the window and said nothing. And I turned and looked at him. And the morning light came through the glass and fell across the both of us, warm and unhurried, like something that had decided to stay. That was enough. That was everything. That was how it ended. Not with a door closing, but with a morning beginning, and the certain, quiet knowledge that this one was ours.